Hey everybody, I'm Luke. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here and to be sober. And thanks for faring the weather and missing the big game to come out and listen to me. Your sponsor sent me to make sure that you were here. And I have you all know you're all getting AA extra credit tonight. So see us at the door to claim your prize for being here tonight. I am grateful to be here and grateful to Dale for asking me to speak. And this is not my favorite thing to do, tell my story, and but it is one of the greatest things I can do. You know, this is the 12 step. That's how I look at it. You know, this is an opportunity to carry a message and hopefully speak to folks who may be suffering from what I've suffered from. And and that's, you know, honestly why I think I've been able to stay sober for, you know, as long as I have, is the willingness to do that, to try to pass this thing on and do what people did for me. So, but anyway, before I get into that, I guess I'll try to qualify how I know I'm an alcoholic. And maybe I'll tell you a little bit about my upbringing, not because it's necessarily relevant to my alcoholism, but it's relevant to my story, and you may relate. I grew up in a house where, I don't know, people talk about like feelings of difference a lot, and that's not, you know, that's not limited to alcoholics by any means. And it was definitely true for me. I was different in every area of my life that I can recall, the most of which being my family. Like I really was like just the black sheep in my family from as long as I can remember. And to kind of give you an idea of like what we were working with, my mom and my, you know, everybody in my family, they were like elders in their church. You know, my mom would like, I would go to church at least twice a week, sometimes three times a week, which seemed a bit excessive to me, you know? And my sister seemed to get something out of church. And just to be honest with you guys, I felt like a hooker in church. You know what I mean? Like I wasn't getting what they were getting. I felt out of place, you know, like I was shoplifting when I was, you know, candy bars when I was seven. You know, my mom had my dad tear my treehouse down when I was eight because she found my porn mags up there. You know what I mean? I was just like, I was different, and you know, those are just a few snapshots, and there were some activities that I really did enjoy, and that was like, you know, running from cops, getting in fights, neither of which I was good at, you know. I was actually really bad at both those things, but it was such a rush, you know, it was so fun. And when I found alcohol, I believe I needed it. And I, you know, my story is not one in which everything was going really well and I was going off to some prestigious university and then started drinking and, you know, threw my life. Honestly, I was a loser, you know, if you haven't gathered that by now, you know, like I was a loser in every area of my life. I had nothing that I could point to and say, well, you know, I really had this going for me. I did get a lot of the, you have so much potential talk, you know, which I know just means you're not amounting to anything, you know, but at the time I thought it was a compliment. It's not, you know, I was a loser in every area of my life. And then when I started drinking, I felt okay about that, you know, that's the best way I could describe it. Like I was, actually, funny enough, when I started drinking, my grades got a little better for a while. Not that much better, but a little better. You know, I felt like I actually had some, like, I don't know, relief from time to time. From what I now know, I didn't have the vocabulary to describe this back then, but, just fear in every area of my life, just everywhere I went, afraid of people, afraid of what people think of me, just that self-centered fear that just consumed me my whole life before I started drinking, into my drinking, you know, but alcohol gave me a little bit of a relief from that. And, and my drinking started, I'll tell you about my first drink, because I guess that's relevant. I was already on probation, so that'll give you an idea, right? I haven't drank anything yet, and I'm on probation. You know what I mean? So I couldn't say that alcohol was the problem in my life. Like I had it before I started drinking, but I was on probation and I was afraid of my PO. It wasn't like a scary man. It was a very attractive woman, and that's why I was afraid of her. And this one night, I decided, me and my one friend, I had one friend, he was a loser too. His name was Lars. He was a German foreign exchange student. And we were like, you know, each other's only friend. So anyway, we decided we're going to split a six pack, and I had four, he had two. And something happened for me in hindsight. I don't know that I could have called that. I, you know, would have called this at the time, but something happened for me that did not happen for Lars. You know, the same thing happened to us. You know, he probably got the same, you know, two drinks in, he probably got the same buzz I got, you know? But I don't know that, but I know that what it did for me was different than what it did for Lars. And I'll try to just describe that. After those four drinks, I remember kind of looking out in the woods and thinking, like, for the first time that I can recall, thinking, like, you know, it ain't so bad. It ain't so bad, you know, and feeling pretty comfortable in my skin. And for the rest of the night, I went to Lars' host parents' liquor cabinet and was taking swigs off this handle of vodka. And then, you know, filling it up with water, like trying to keep the lump, you know, I was probably drinking pretty watery vodka by the end of the night. And I remember Lars like saying, you need to stop. Like he was like worried about like getting in trouble and getting deported, or it was ridiculous to me. Like I felt like it was being a total buzzkill, you know? And this is what's important, right? I was not afraid of my PO anymore. I was actually excited that she's coming by, you know, and I felt like she might be excited too, you know, and I'm 14, you know, I pimpled face, I'm probably 90 pounds soaking wet, you know, like, but I'm thinking something might happen tonight, you know, and nothing did that night or, you know, any night for a long time, but, you know, but I felt like there was a chance, and that's a big deal for a loser like me, you know, and that's what alcohol did for me. And I would go to parties, and I would the plan would be to, you know, make some friends or get laid, or I don't know, you know, like make a friend, like, you know, just stop being such a loser. But I would be such a nervous wreck and so unlikable. And I don't know, this is just how I felt about myself, but I would start drinking. And I don't know if anybody will relate with this, but then I'd start doing math. Right. That's what would happen. I'd start like two drinks in, I'm doing math and I'm looking at how many people we got and how much alcohol we got. And I'm like calculating, do we have a problem or no, we're good. You know, that's a big shift. And whoever I was like trying to impress or whatever an hour ago, like is a number now, you know, and they're offsetting my alcohol ratio, you know, and they should leave, like, you know, so like from the beginning, when I would start drinking, my perception would change. And again, this is like years in the sobriety that I could kind of look at that and say, okay, that's what was happening, you know. Years into sobriety after years of denial, you know, or delusion, as I prefer to call it. But so that's like what my drinking would look like at the beginning. You know, I would, I have such a lame story. I really do. Like I had nothing, I didn't drink and wake up in different countries. I would, like at the beginning of my drinking, honestly, I would like wake up in a bush, you know, like so not know where I was, like that would happen. And then like fast forward and I would wake up like in a bunk bed under a light like that, you know, like one of these and not know where I was. And that would happen a lot. Like I would drink and wake up in an institution. And there was like, at this point in my life, like I wasn't sure what was wrong with me or what my problem was. You know, like I actually questioned if I was like, you know, a sociopath or, you know, a narcissist. I didn't know what these big words meant, but when you kind of read the description at the time, I was like, you know, like it kind of worried me. And like, I would ask myself questions like, do I love and care about my family? If I do, then why do I keep doing this? You know? And I mean, I have answers to these questions now, but I didn't at the time. And you know, there were scary questions to ask. And you know, but one thing that I was sure of at that time was that I hated being institutionalized. I hated not being able to drink when I want to drink, or how much I want to drink, but I really hated people telling me what to do, when to do this. And every time I was, I'd make a commitment that I'm never going to do this again. And I'd always wake up in a rickety bunk bed underneath a fluorescent light, you know, like it just happened all the time. And that's my story. You know, my drinking was constantly interrupted by police officers and judges and being court mandated to institutions and stuff like that. You know, I will say this, in between like being institutionalized, like the end of my drinking, I'll try to kind of paint a picture of what that looked like. And it was like, if I was honest with myself, it's not going to get any better. You know, there's no hope. Well, there's nothing. There really isn't. Like, there's nothing like I can point to and say, you know, but when this happens, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to turn it around. I still got this going for me. There's nothing like that. It was, you know, life is just like on a downward trajectory for me, like slowly but surely getting worse and worse. And every 6 months, something like really bad would happen. And I was always waiting like for a court case. And I always had a court case coming up that I would like try to be sober for or something. Right. And back then, I don't know what they do now, but back then they would drug test me, but they wouldn't test me for alcohol. But I like quickly found out that when I start drinking, all bets are off on it, anything, you know what I mean? So I would like fail these drug tests and go, what? No, I didn't even know, you know, like I didn't know. And but I was drunk and so I found out like, okay, I can't drink either. I gotta try to just be sober, be stone cold sober like I am right now. And I was usually pretty resourceful. I was rarely homeless is what I mean. Like I wasn't doing well for myself. I didn't mean to sound like that. But I usually had a roof over my head. I usually had convinced a family member or someone to let me stay for a while, which they would always come to regret. You know, I was an unwelcome hanger on, you know, I was a leech. And at the end of my drinking, I smelled, I didn't shower. I didn't, do laundry. I was pretty gross. And yeah, honestly, like I would think about everything I've done and think about my life and what do I really have to look forward to? And I would say, screw it. That's really what would happen. And I would start drinking. And it's important for me to remember this, that even at that point in my life, a few drinks in, I would have the thought, you know, I'm not such a bad guy. I'm not such a bad guy. I was, by every metric possible. You know, I was not a good guy, but I felt like one a few drinks in. I felt like tomorrow's going to be a good day. To kind of date my drinking, I would think like, tomorrow I'm going to return that movie to Blockbuster. You know what I mean? I'm going to return it and I'm going to get another one. If you don't remember those days, if you have that movie for 7 days or something like that, you own it, whether you like it or not. And I owned a lot of movies I didn't like because I couldn't get them. I couldn't do it. You know, I would think tomorrow I'm going to do some laundry or tomorrow I'm going to take a shower and tomorrow's going to be a good day. Tomorrow's going to be a good day. And you know, obviously tomorrow never came because I'd wake up tomorrow and do the exact same thing. So, my story was, like I said, I was just institutionalized all the time. My drinking was constantly interrupted. I got sent to Fishburne Military School, and the courts mandated me there, and I was on probation. And it's funny, I just mentioned that because I live in Waynesboro now. It was like actually there was two when I first got sober, there was like two places that I just couldn't go, and that was Stanton and Waynesboro, right? Because every cop in Stanton knows me. A lot of cops in Waynesboro know me. You know, I was just like, and honestly, it's a big world. And there's two pretty small places. I don't ever have to go there. You know what I mean? I got sent there and I was on probation and I got drunk one night and got an assault charge, got kicked out, violation of probation. And I remember I mentioned this because this was a time in my life where I like really wanted to stop drinking. And I went to, I stood in front of the same judge in Stanton like three times. I wish I remembered this guy's name. Every now and then I speak and someone comes up to me. It's like, I know who it was. And they tell me, but I forget. But anyway, I stood in front of the same judge in Stanton like three times. And this time I'm sure I was going away, you know, like I had a friend who had been locked up for a while. Told me like any, you know, white underwear you're wearing, like white t-shirts or whitey tighties, you can take with you, you know, when you get locked up. So layer up, you know what I mean? So I was layered, and I was hot and under my suit, you know, and I put on a good show. Like I wore a suit to court, you know, like I was like, at least I can like try, you know, I was like, I screwed up real bad, but let me try to sell this judge, you know, like I was that guy. I was that obnoxious guy. But anyway, I'm hot, because I got eight pairs of underwear on and I remember this, I basically got off with a technicality. I had a pretty good lawyer, I guess. And I don't remember, but I should have gone away because it was a violation of probation with an assault charge. And I had 5 years of like backup time that I was supposed to serve. And I got sentenced to probation again, right? Which was, it was basically like no one expected it and it wasn't supposed to happen. And I remember the judge saying something to the effect of, you know, Mr. Hoagie, if I see you in my courtroom again for jaywalking, you're going to jail, or I'm going to bury you under the jail, or something to that effect. Something mean, I felt at the time, you know, and any idiot looking at my life at this time would say that young man should stop drinking. That young man should stop, you know, doing what he's doing. And this idiot thought that, like, I meant it. Like, I'm, I know I need to stop. But I know I was drunk that night too. Like, I know I was celebrating some victory that wasn't mine, you know, that I didn't get locked up, you know, like I know that. And long story short, that judge never saw me in his courtroom again, because the next time I got arrested, I was in a different state, which worked out well at the time, because they didn't like communicate like they do now. So I was just, you know, sent to institutions. I think that was in Utah the next time I was arrested. I don't know. I guess I don't want to talk ad nauseum about all the institutions I went to, but ultimately I got sent to a place in upstate New York, and that's kind of where I was like really exposed to AA, because there was big books on the shelves there and they allowed people from AA to come in and honestly just do exactly what I'm doing right now. Like, just tell their story. And what I didn't know at the time was that these people, they were like young people. I was, you know, 19 when I got sober. There was people that came in to this institution in upstate New York, and they came from like this area. They came from Virginia and DC and Maryland, and they, you know, they weren't paid to be there. They paid for their way. They paid their, you know, for their hotel and their own gas and just came in and just tell their story, you know, just because a few of them had been there and they knew there was alcoholics there. And I was institutionalized for a long time, for years. And the last time I was institutionalized was for more than 2 years, and I was physically sober. And when I left, I was going back to Stanton, and I had this, you know, idea, that like, I would have said that I was an alcoholic if I was honest with you, but I did not. There's actually a line in our 12 and 12 about the first step that I really like today. And that's, you know, under the lash of alcoholism, we're driven to AA, and there we discover the fatal nature of our situation, some of that effect. And that's true. And what I hang on to that, what part I'm hanging on to about that passage is it was here that I discovered, in AA, that I discovered the fatal nature of my situation, because I didn't know what it truly meant to be alcoholic. I knew that when I drink, trouble follows. I knew that when I drink, I can't control the outcome of what's going to happen. Like, I knew that. So that's what I meant when I would say, oh yeah, I'm such an alcoholic back in the day. Right. But I didn't know that, like, what I know today is that I'm doomed to drink again, no matter how long I'm sober, no matter how bad I don't want to, no matter how much AA extra credit I got, you know, like, I am doomed to drink again, unless there's something, some power greater than me standing between me and that next drink. And, you know, And I told you guys, you know, like the religious upbringing I had and what I brought into AA, you know, and I wanted no part to that. But I, you know, anyway, I went to AA and it was really easy for me to, I guess the term we use here is relate out or differentiate myself from everybody. Like I'd done my whole life in every room I'd ever been in, let alone when, you know, I'm going to this place where you guys want so much time. It just seemed like a lot of time. And it also seemed like the solution you guys have here doesn't seem like it really fits the problem I'm trying to solve, right? Being you guys are talking about God and I just want to stop getting arrested. You know what I mean? And you guys are talking about like service and spirit. It just seemed like, you know, you guys are missing the mark here. You know what I mean? You guys are missing the mark for me. And really, I think you could have put me in a room full of people that looked just like me, drank just like me, and I would have found a reason to be different at the time. And that's what I did. Actually, I would have said, I wouldn't have said this, but in my head, I thought that there was more options. That's really the truth of it. I thought I had more options. I thought I had one more option than I actually did, right? Like I had heard the jails, institutions of death on one hand, spiritual way of life, coming to AA, having a good life, staying sober. And then I thought there was this elusive option C, which is don't go to AA. Don't be inconvenienced for the rest of your life and also have a good life. And I thought, and let me be clear, that option is available to most people. It's just not available to alcoholics, right? So I thought that's what I would do, you know. Honestly, at this point in my life, things are looking better than they ever had. I had gotten a GED, then I was like able to get a diploma. I got accepted to college. I was going to college, like that's huge for a guy like me, you know. And then I had a job. I was like bussing tables at a retirement home, but it was a job, you know. Like this was huge for me. Like I'm unemployable. Like I'm 2 years physically sober, institutionalized, but physically sober. Like things are looking pretty good for me. And anyway, I was out of this institution for 10 days. And I got invited to a 4th of July party where I knew there'd be drinking. I said no, because I knew there'd be drinking there. I didn't want to drink. And by the end of the night, I was drinking alone in my basement. And at this, granted, this is, you know, 17 years ago, so I don't remember, but I really don't remember negotiating this drink. Which is crazy if you think about, you know, I'm sober a few years. I don't remember thinking like, oh, this is a good idea. This is a bad idea. I really don't this time. There's actually a part that I really relate to in the book where it talks about like drinking as carelessly as those drinks were ginger ales. And that's what I was doing. Like it's out of mind. And a few drinks in, the first thought I do remember having is, holy crap, I just threw away 2.5 years sober and this is going to get bad. And then just getting as drunk as I physically could, you know, and you know, it's funny because I could mention like if I want to talk about the end of my drinking, I could talk about, you know, I don't know, a dozen nights that were way worse, you know, really like I actually hear this pretty common in AA. People talk about just feeling completely terrified and lonely and that was how I felt. That was how I felt. I was, and I didn't plan on getting sober. I'll say that. I was tricked into coming to AA. I was tricked into coming to AA again. I had a friend ask me to come to, if I would come to AA to support him. And there's like two things that would have got me to go to an AA meeting. One is like, actually maybe just one, was feed my ego. That's what he did. You know, he asked me to like help and support him because I'm such a good friend. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll support you. And that's where I would meet my first sponsor. It was my first meeting. And this guy, he, you know, it was right out of the book. I mean, I wasn't, you know, well-versed on the big book at the time, but now I know, okay, you're basically just following this manual. He barely, if at all, talked about my drinking. He may have asked me a few questions, but really he just talked about his own drinking. That's what he did. He just talked about his drinking. And what alcohol did for him and why he drank in spite of the consequences he was getting. and things like that. And because of that, I was willing to listen to things this guy said, whereas my whole life I've had well-meaning, well-intentioned, well-qualified people giving me good advice, like stop drinking, stop, you know, whatever. And I never listened to anybody, even though I should have, right? And maybe I couldn't have, I don't know. Anyway, questions left for more intelligent men. But, you know, this guy, I believed, understood the way I felt and understood why I drank the way I drank. And I could see that his life was different. And he tricked me into taking spiritual actions that I didn't know were spiritual. And that's kind of been like my journey in AA, you know, because like I said, you know, it seemed like you guys didn't really have what I was looking for. You know, and if you're new, I don't know if anybody here is, but if you're new and, you know, this doesn't look like what you're looking for, it doesn't mean you're in the wrong place. We've all felt that way. Like, I always joke and say, like, nobody walks in and sees the 12 steps and thinks, I was just about to do that. You know, to be honest, they look like real bad ideas to me. You know, like once I learned what inventory meant, you know, like I'm going to write down everything I've done. You know, that's, you know, I've been in courtrooms enough to know you don't do that. You know, like I'm going to pay back all the money I stole. Right. If I knew that I would be paying it back, I would not have stolen it, you know, like needless to say. And really just to sum it all up, you're going to be inconvenienced for the rest of your life. And you know, these, it just seemed like 12 bad ideas. And I didn't want anything to do with that. And I talked a little bit about how I felt about religion and God and, you know, but I really relate with that Dr. Bob talking about, you know, he made a commitment to himself that I made as well, that once he was free from parental domination, he would never darken the doors of a church again. And I made that commitment and here I am, you know, like, but I did, like, I felt that way. Like, I'm never going to have to do this again. And my sponsor, actually, I pretty quickly felt like I got a bad sponsor. Because when I would come to him with what I thought were real issues, and in my life, they were, you know, like, I think I don't have those types of problems today. You know what I mean? They were like big deals. Like to me, they'd be like today, I can't imagine dealing, like having to navigate through those types of issues. Like, you know, anyway, you know, I digress, but he would, I would like come to him with these issues and it seemed like his solution to everything was to stack the chairs after the meeting, you know, it was like, or make coffee or do something like that. And he told me that the women in AA like the guys that stack the chairs after the meeting. They don't notice, by the way, you know, but I would stack, I was the guy with four chairs under each arm and, you know, hurting my back trying to, you know, like I would do these things. And he would tell me, he had my number and not because he's brilliant or anything, just because, you know, we're all kind of the same, you know, and he would tell me that, you know, that, when I had a month sober, he told me to pick up a chip at every meeting I go to that week that gives out chips, not just don't get just one chip. You know, if they give it, you know, you go to multiple meetings that week that give out a chip, pick it up there. And I loved that. You know, I felt like, cause you guys clapped for me. And I just felt that was like a new feeling, you know, for me to be clapped at. I'd never really done much clap worthy in my life. You know, like I just, you know, like I felt like you guys were clapping for me. And now I know you weren't, you know, your clap is, it's for AA and it's the whole purpose in picking up chips is to bear witness that, you know, that this works. And that's why we do that. It's not just to make the newcomer feel good about something, but you know, I felt like you guys were clapping at me. So I would pick up chips and it was like, everything was like that. You know, in order to make friends, I would have to go do service. Cause that's where like I would make friends. He also did this. My sponsor also did this move, which I've since tried to master, where I would go up and talk to him at a meeting about a problem I have. And he would introduce me to like another unbearable new guy. And be like, Luke, this is John, this is Luke. And then he would walk away. He would do it all the time. And I would like be stuck giving this guy a ride home. you know, and it would happen all the time. And I didn't know at the time that what he was doing for me was what I couldn't do for myself, which was, you know, try to get some relief from this self-centeredness. And what I've come to determine for myself and for the guys I sponsor and many people in AA, if not all of us, is that our problem isn't our, like what we think our problems are. Our problem, and this is true for me today as much as it was when I got here, my problem is my obsession with my problem and fixing my problems and my obsession with myself and how you guys perceive me and how, you know, that's the issue. And the only solution to that is other-centeredness, you know, service to get out of myself and things like that. And, you know, so he started me off on that pretty early. I will say that when I first got sober, that obsession to drink, which I always had, I didn't have the vocabulary. I wouldn't have called it that. I wanted to drink, you know, but that obsession that I always had seemed to go away for a little bit, like 2 weeks, and then come back really strong for me. And I remember, being 2 weeks sober in the Shenandoah Valley. And I actually remember, I think it was a Saturday. And wanting to drink starting early in the morning, you know, like I just wanted to drink. And I wish I remembered all the meetings. I remember a lot of them. I went to 5 meetings that day. I'd never gotten drunk in a meeting. These are like the toolkit I had at the time. I knew I'd never gotten drunk in a meeting. I had been intoxicated in a meeting, but I didn't get that way there. You know, so I felt like if I go to meetings, that's just like a safe place. And I went to, there was like a tent, and I was driving between Harrisonburg and Fishersville and Stanton and Verona. Like I was going to all these meetings. And I remember the last meeting of the night was at 10 PM club room meeting in Stanton. And on the way there from the 8 PM meeting at the club room in Harrisonburg, I'm driving to Stanton. It occurs to me that I should call my sponsor. Right. I've been all day just obsessing about a drink. Right. But never occurred to me that I should call my sponsor. And I did. I called him and he gave me what at the time seemed to be the worst idea I'd ever heard in my life, which was to go to the meeting and share that I was thinking about drinking. And I didn't know much about AA, but I thought telling you guys that I planned to drink after the meeting might be frowned upon. But it's not actually, it's not, if you're new, I'll warn you. What he didn't warn me is that if you do that, you will get surrounded and it will be annoying. It's going to be annoying. And I was surrounded and it was annoying. And everybody wanted to talk to me after, especially the people I didn't want to talk to, which was pretty much everybody, but there was a scale, you know what I mean? And the people at the top of the scale wanted to talk the most. And there was this guy who I really didn't like. This guy was like 6'4" and covered in camo from head to toe. I just felt he looked like he hadn't shaved or showered since he got sober, and he'd been sober 33 years. You know what I mean? So I felt, I was judgmental, and I felt like I don't relate with this guy. And he came up to me and he asked me what I was doing after the meeting. And I felt like I knew the answer to that question was, you know, I'm just going to go home and go to sleep and not drink. And he said, again, I used to think like people in AA were so brilliant that they could persuade me to do things. And in hindsight, I just know I'm just like an insecure little man, you know? And he said like the magic words to me, he said, what I'm asking is, are you going to be a pansy and go home? He didn't say pansy, but I'm saying pansy for the sake of the word, and go home. Or are you going to come to the Waffle Inn and have some coffee? And I was like, what? You know, what do you mean? Well, I'm not a pansy, so obviously I'll have a cup of coffee, you know. And I followed this guy to the Waffle Inn, and this guy stayed up with me, and I think until like two in the morning, just smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and talking to me about, this was important because he had gotten sober when he was 23 in the 70s, which now I know is like, that's like getting sober when you're 9 now. You know what I mean? Like that's a big deal. And he had gotten sober young. He understood like how, I was living in Stanton. I was the youngest person in the meeting by, you know, 85 years and you know and he understood and which, you know, going off my judgments, I would have never, you know, I would have never thought of that. And I went to bed that night, and that was like the first experience I had had like that, where I wanted to drink but didn't. And I think about that a lot, because I think about like my life today and how comfortable it is, and how much he gave me the most valuable thing he had, which was his time. Like how much of that he gave me, and thank God for that. And I hope I'm willing to do that today. When, you know, when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, you know, I hope I'm willing, you know, to offer that type of help. And I don't know, you know, I'm grateful to that guy. And it's funny. He's sober 30 years and 2 days longer than me. All right, we have because my anniversary was the 5th of July. His is the 3rd of July. I still call him on his anniversary every year. And then he forgets to call me every year on mine 2 days later, you know, but I'm still very close to that guy. And I guess just kind of fast forward, you know, what I had talked about, like my relationship with God, like I would feel uncomfortable in this meeting now with how many times I've said that word so far. To be honest, I'm just telling you where I was coming from. Like I would prefer if you use the term power greater than yourself, higher power. Like I knew what you were saying. I wasn't that dumb. But I felt like, I don't know. I would bristle with antagonism when people would talk about God in an AA meeting. And now it's like, I'm sorry. Like I got nothing for you. If you want to take that word out of my story, you know, that's like what the book says, like the central fact of my life is that there's a power greater than Luke. Thank God. But anyway, when I came here, there's actually, I like that line that talks about the flimsy reed. What once seemed a flimsy reed proved to be the hand of a loving and powerful God. And I would describe AA that way as well. Like that, you guys were the flimsy reed, and it's like, you know, you're falling off a cliff, and you just grab onto these weeds, not because you think it's going to support your weight, or you don't think about it. You know, you're falling off a cliff, and you just grabbing onto what's there, pretty sure it's not going to work. And that's how I would have described AA. You know, this was just the last stop. I'm pretty sure this isn't going to work. And little by little, my perspective on these things would change. And I don't know when it happened. I don't know. I can try to pinpoint some things, you know, as I was going through the steps, like different experiences I had. But I don't know, like, when this psychic change took place. I mean, I do intellectually know it happened over time, right? And I can, like I said, I can pinpoint some things, but you know, it's my belief that if you're, at least for me, when I was willing to write a fourth step, which again seemed like a really bad idea, when I was like willing to write these things down, or I was willing to miss the Super Bowl to come to a meeting, or when I was willing to do these things that seemed like really bad ideas because someone else had suggested them, that's a pretty good indicator of my third step. You know, like am I willing to turn my life over to the care and direction of something else? Or do I need to be completely in control? And I got to tell you this, you know, you say the third step, and that's the third step, you know, but this is a lifelong errand here. And I'll talk more about that, like where I've been at recently, but I did do a fourth step, and at the time I would have it seemed like just a list of all the things that made me different from you guys, you know, like all the things that made me better, all the things that made me worse, all the things that were going to shock my sponsor, all the things that were going to make him say, okay, maybe you're not in the right place. Like, let's find somewhere better for you, young man, sicko, you know, like that, like I had like this blueprint. And that was not the reaction I got from my sponsor. Actually, you know, he related a lot and shared some things with me. If you would have asked me how I felt after doing a four step, at the time I would have told you I feel worse I feel worse. I feel like I still, these things are all still true, but now someone else knows them about me. You know, but in hindsight, actually the home group I was in at the time in Northern Virginia, they used to do this thing, which I thought was so obnoxious. They would say, after you did your fifth step, they would say, "Welcome to AA. Welcome to AA." Like, I've been here. Like, what do you mean? You know, but today I think there's actually some truth to that. Like, I became an AA member when I did that. And not just like, because I just did the first tangible work or whatever, put pen to whatever, you know, like I feel like I became an AA member because, those differences kind of dissolved a little bit, you know, and I felt like I could be an AA member, maybe even just a member of society. You know, like I felt like someone out there relates with me and I'm not alone. And I couldn't have got that by skipping this step. And then, you know, kind of being entirely ready to have God remove all those things that I had just written down, you know, that really is as simple as the sixth step is, you know, like, am I entirely ready to have these things removed? Or is there something that I'm not willing to give up? Because if I'm being honest, and this is probably true for all of us, every defect of character that I have at least at one point was a tool in my life, was a tool that I probably needed in my life, was a tool that served me, you know? So it's actually a pretty difficult question, you know, because when we ask ourselves, am I ready to have these defects removed? What do we think of? We think of the ones that are causing us grief right now, you know, at least I do. I don't think of the ones that are stopping me from being helpful to God's kid. You know, I think of like, oh, this is costing me a lot of money, you know, or whatever, you know, this is keeping me up at night. I want this removed. But the question is, am I willing to have them all removed? And if I can answer satisfactorily to that question, then I say this seven-step prayer, which is in the book. And I misread that seven-step prayer for years. No, I don't mean like I read the word, like I read it correctly, but I misunderstood it. You know, because I thought I was asking God to remove the defects of character, like I talked about, that was, you know, that were causing me a little bit of trouble, that were causing me pain, you know, when really I'm asking that they be removed, especially only the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and the people about me. Spoiler alert, my experience is they're not going to get removed. Sorry, it is the bad news. You know, I still have every defect of character that I had when I got here, you know, but I'm willing and I've asked for them to be removed, but I still have them all. I will say they cause me a lot less trouble. I get in a lot. Oh my God, I get in a lot less trouble than I did when I got here, but I still have all this defects of character. I'm still, you know, and honestly, some, they're probably not new to me, new that I can recognize them and know what they are, you know, pop up as well. You know, but I still have every defect of character. And honestly, you know, it's none of my business whether or not they get removed. It isn't, you know. All that's my business is that I ask God to remove them so that I can be helpful to other people. And I actually can share a few practical things that I've done in regards to these steps that have helped a lot. Similar to my alcoholism, the more that I concealed it or tried to hide it, the less useful I was and the more hopeless I was to ever stop drinking. And I've had defects where the more I tried to hide them from you all, the stronger they became. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm not saying that I'm going to come up to the podium and, you know, tell you, you know, everything I, you know, I'm doing on the dark web or, you know, anything like that, you know, but I'm saying I am willing to help. That's like that was a real practical thing. Like try to help people with the same defects that plagued me. And I found that they brought me a lot less grief in regards to that. You know, when I was willing to share, conservatively, when I was willing to share what was going on and then also try to help others with those same things. And I guess, you know, once you get to a place, where you're, you know, you're living in the solution, where your life looks different. And again, I can't pinpoint when this happened, but I can tell you, you know, I can tell you in my first year sober, I had the first day, I think it was my first year sober. It might've been a year. It might've been a little, I don't know. I had a day where I didn't think about drinking, which was a big deal, right? Because I was one of the, and it's not everybody's experience, but I was one of those that obsessed about drinking well into sobriety. Like I would go to the meeting and, you know, I would do the service and I was uncomfortable. I wasn't living in the sunlight of the spirit for a long time. You know, I actually, when I stopped drinking and started coming to AA, it looked like my life got worse for a little bit. I wasn't getting arrested, you know, anymore, but I certainly felt worse. I felt worse when I had to stop drinking. And that fear that I talked about having as a kid, I had, you know, maybe even magnified when I got sober. And it ran my life. Like I would, I've dropped out of community college twice sober, you know, just cause I was too scared to show up to gym class. You know, really that's what, like, the best that I could do at that point in my life, this is like my first couple of years sober. The best I could do was like try to withdraw from the class before I had to take an F. You know what I mean? Like this, that was like, I also drove 90. I've gotten speeding tickets on 29 here, reckless driving tickets. I drove 90 miles an hour everywhere I went. And it was not like I was late for work or anything. I was borderline unemployable and hardly employed when I was new, you know, but I was just a jerk. You know, I drove 90 miles an hour everywhere. My hope, when I was new was just that I could not go to jail sober, you know, because a lot of times it looked like I was going to go to jail sober. And, you know, like I really was like just plagued with defects of character. And in hindsight, I didn't drop out of community college because I was dumb. I thought that at the time, but now I know it was that fear. And I'll try to like explain what that looked like. I would do whatever assignment I had to do to the best of my ability. I would wake up, I would plan. I actually lived 45 minutes from the college I was going to. So it was a long drive. I would drive all the way there. I would get out, I would walk up. Sometimes I would look into the window of the classroom. I would keep walking, you know, I would get back in my car. I would drive all the way home, go to sleep, you know, and then I'd like call my sponsor and tell him how lazy I was, you know, and I wasn't like, I put so much effort into not showing up, you know, and I was prepared, but I was afraid. That's what it was. I was afraid. And it was hard for me to like describe that because I wasn't afraid of like getting into a fist fight and getting beat up, you know, or anything like that. But I was terrified to go to class or the grocery store or, you know, somewhere, you know, I was terrified of people, terrified of the biggest fear I always had was like being exposed for who I really was. Like someone's going to figure me out. And this was like into sobriety. Like I would feel that way. And, you know, so that's what I was dealing with, you know, and, to better paint you a picture, my sponsor, I remember my first Mother's Day sober, he asked what I was doing for Mother's Day. And I'm like ashamed to admit this, but at the time I remember thinking and maybe saying Mother's Day, like it, don't just mothers celebrate mother. Like I'm not a mother, you know, what are you talking? Like, I don't have any plans for Mother's Day. That was like, it was a ridiculous question to me. And he said, why don't you go surprise your mom for Mother's Day, go get flowers. Buy them the same day. Like I didn't know these things, but you got to buy the flowers the same day and just go surprise your mom. And I remember when I went to my mom's house, again, I was going to college up in Northern Virginia and she was in Stanton. I walked in her kitchen and she screamed. She turned around and screamed and punched me in the chest because she was so shocked. Like, you know, in hindsight, like I'm not proud of this, but it was like more likely in my mom's mind that someone was breaking into her house in broad daylight on Mother's Day than her son was coming to bring her flowers. Like that's what I brought to you guys. That's who I was, you know, that's the type of guy I was. And you know, so anyway, when I did this 8-step, I used the 4-step, you know, I added a few names, but I had caused a lot of harm. And you know, there is a key part of that 8-step is, you know, becoming willing to make amends to them all, you know, even people that I'm still mad at or people who hurt me more than I hurt them or, you know, because the whole idea here is that we put out of mind other people's mistakes entirely, right? And the way my sponsor described that to me was that, you know, you got to stop talking about your part versus their part. You can't talk about parts without, you can't put out of mind the other person's mistakes entirely if you're still talking about whose part is who. You know, if people still have parts, you haven't done it yet. And, you know, so he was like really big on that word mistakes, and, you know, that I had made mistakes, even if the only mistake I had made was that I had held a grudge this long. You know, so I started to go make some of these amends once I was in a place to do so. And, you know, and I actually had a lot of different experiences. I've had the not great ones of, you know, get out of my office, you know, no thanks. Like, I don't, and they're not wrong for that. I definitely have a lot of amends that I'm still ready and willing to make, you know, but I have no right to go track these people down and bring up a bunch of old stuff and ruin their life. But if I ever run into them, I'm ready to make those amends. You know, like I talked about earlier, there was like a couple places I couldn't go, you know, just because I might run into someone. It was more than just cops, you know. It was like I didn't want to run into people. And I don't feel that way today. I really don't. Like, I'm not afraid of, there are some people that I owe to. And if, you know, I see them, I'm ready and willing to make those amends. And these are the ones that I couldn't reach out to. Most of them I could, you know, and I've, actually, I'll share this experience. This was, I think, important to my story. I went to my sponsor used to tell me that when I would go visit my family to go to church with them on Sunday morning, because it made them happy. I still kind of felt the same way about church. But I, you know, this was like sponsor direction. I'm going to go to church and make my family happy. So I would go, and I still felt like a hooker in church. I always felt that way. Like, I just felt like I like physically uncomfortable. When I was in, not like when I was in an AA meeting, that was like different at this point, but when I was sitting in a church service, especially my parents, you know, but I would go and my sponsor, again, like I used to think AAs were brilliant at a certain point, you know, he suggested that maybe I felt uncomfortable in church. Because in that church specifically, because I had stolen so much money out of the offering plate, and maybe I should return that. You know what I mean? And I remember when I did that, I told the pastor, you know, what I thought I had taken and what I'm trying to do and how I'm trying to be different. And I remember I went back and sat down in my chair, and I felt like a sigh of relief, like that first drink, it was physical. I felt like relief. And I remember to this day what that sermon was about, which is kind of crazy, you know? Like that's how present I was at that moment. And, you know, so I've had experiences like that. Not all of them. Like I said, I've had not pleasant, immense experiences, and they're just as valuable. You know, like the whole point is that I need to clear up my side of the street here. And anyway, so the 10th step is kind of just, you know, to keep doing what we've been talking about, you know, like admit when I'm wrong, continue to take inventory, which I learned how to do in the 4th step. I've been pretty consistent about that in my sobriety. When I start to feel a little off, I like write out an inventory. Other than that, I just have a few folks that I'm honest with, including my sponsor, about like what's going on. My sponsor knows the whole story. And then there's like a couple, like I would probably all have this. Like I have some friends who, you know, we really relate on this. So we talk about this and we really relate here. And I'm current in that regard, you know, but I am certainly, still wrong today, you know, and I gotta say that doesn't get easier. Maybe I'm just an egomaniac, but I am, but maybe I'm more so, I don't know, but it doesn't get easier necessarily to admit that I'm wrong. And actually, I have like this idea today sometimes, which is wrong, which is incorrect, that I shouldn't be feeling this way since I'm sober this long, or I shouldn't, you know, act whatever, because I'm sober this long, or this is unacceptable, you know, and it's harder for me to admit to myself when I'm wrong, but I still have to do it. Like my life depends on, Actually, I'll kind of, that's a good point to kind of segue into like, you know, what sobriety has kind of looked like for me, because, you know, I've had great things. I've had, really hard times, you know, in spite of myself, I've had wonderful gifts in sobriety, you know, like that Mother's Day story that I was talking about when I was like 3 years sober or 4 years sober. I just bought a new car and got fired the next day, you know, like I was still kind of just like bouncing around life, not doing too well, but I had this new car with dead tags and empty gas tank and really cool car, you know, and I remember I went to this, it was the day before Mother's Day, and I went to this, where I was living at the time, or the home group I was in at the time, they did these things. When someone was about to have a year, they'd have what they called a watch the night before, which is weird. And, you know, it's like they stay up till midnight and watch you get a year, I guess, to make sure you don't drink. I think it's just an excuse to get us together, you know, but that's like what we would do. We'd like, oh, we got to watch them, you know? And it was crazy. Like people would, like they would count down and people would yell, check their breath. And like, it was madness, you know? And, but it was just an AA party. And anyway, I was at one the day before Mother's Day, my sponsor was there and he asked me what I was doing for Mother's Day. And I remember, like saying, I don't have a plan this year, man. Like I got no way to get down to Stanton. And he looked at me and he just said, make it happen, which was an obnoxious answer at the time. But that's what I did. I remember I panhandled some money at that party, which will make you really feel like a winner when you're a couple of years sober and you're asking your friends for some money. And, you know, but that's what I did. And then I had a friend there who said he was going down to visit his mom in Charlottesville. And after that, we could drive across the mountain and visit mine in Stanton. And that's what we did. You know, I remember I pulled into my mom's driveway and she pulled in behind me and she had been out shopping or something. And she had a big smile on her face. And she said, I knew you'd be here. And I said, I know, Mom, I was trying to surprise you. And she said, the only way you could surprise me today is if you didn't show up. And I was this close, you know, and it was you guys, it was AA that showed up for my mom. And you honestly you copy and paste that to like the rest of my life, you know, but it's just because like I do what you guys suggest. I show up to things I don't necessarily want to, things that make me uncomfortable. And life has gotten pretty good as a result of doing those things. And I went back to school and realized I wasn't dumb. You know, I thought I was, but it was just fear. Like I talked about, and found out that I was actually interested in things and you know, I was able to graduate. I have a good life. I got married. You guys heard my wife's story a couple of weeks ago. There was a period where she left and thought she was an alcoholic. Spoiler alert, she is, you know, and that was a real hard time to go through. That was a real growing experience for me. And now I have two kids. I'll be honest with you guys. I just want to be honest, you know, time kind of slipped away from me, but you know, for a long time, it seems like in sobriety, I've managed well. And you probably know what I mean by that. Like I felt like I had control in every area of my life. And I don't feel that way today, you know, like with my business, kids will make you feel that way. You know, like I thought you asked me 4 years ago, and I got a real strong program. You know, today I know I'm just really good at setting up my life to suit me. And my kids don't care about that. You know, I have a 2-year-old and another that's about to be one. And actually that's a good example of when I'm wrong, promptly admitted. I had an incident a couple of weeks ago where my 2-year-old was slamming a gate in like a baby gate in my baby son's face. And I lost it. I like slammed the gate open and I yelled and I said, don't do that, Luke. And I'm not proud of this, but I looked down and I saw my son who I love dearly, you know, his face was white. And he was terrified. And he said, Daddy, please be happy. That's what he said. He was 2 years old. And I thought, when I'm wrong, probably admit it, you know, and that was an example. Like, and in hindsight, like what was more important, like I talked to him, I told him I was wrong, I gave him a hug. I said, I am happy. And I was wrong. And I not because he understands necessarily what that means, because I do, you know, I need to do that. And more important, than getting my son to stop hitting his brother in the face, which I can't do, by the way. I can do my best, but more important than that is that he sees his dad admit that he's wrong, you know? And these are things that I've learned along the way from you guys, you know, really. My life is completely different today. As a result of listening to ideas that at one point I thought were pretty poor ideas, you know? So I was pretty sure this wouldn't work for me. That's what I'll say. I'm pretty sure AA wouldn't work for me. And now, like, you can't deny the evidence of a loving God, you know, because we're all folks who should be drunk and we're not, you know? So thanks for letting me share. Wow.